The delighted defense minister then proceeded to spin out a series of Greek, Armenian, and Israeli jokes and ended up by saying, "Well, I have to give equal treatment to the Arabs. I can't let you think I'm anti-Semitic." With that, Mohammed let loose several hilarious jokes mocking his own countrymen. As Gust and Mohammed began to bond, Gust discovered how valuable a relationship with Abu Rasala could be. The quality of the weapons and ammunition the Egyptians had been producing for the Afghan operation was so mixed that the Cairo station had been requesting the right to inspect the factory, but after 4 months, they had been unable to get anyone to even give them an answer. At dinner, Abu Rasala just waved his hand and told Gust that everything was possible for Charlie's friends. They could visit the factory in the morning. The rest of the trip was a dizzying roller coaster. The previously inaccessible 303 factories sprang open just as promised. The CIA contingent found it hard to believe their eyes as they watched the Egyptian men loitering about, smoking next to the explosive stores of gunpowder, while women, their hands moving like machine guns, filled cartridges with thimbles full of the black substance. To Gust, it was like stepping back in time. The factories looked just like the descriptions he had once read of conditions in 19th-century New England textile mills. "Mind you, we were in a Muslim nation where women are not supposed to participate, but all the quality control stations were run by women," he says. When Avrakatos queried General Yeya about all the women supervisors, he replied, "Apparently, you've never been married to an Egyptian woman. They're real sons of bitches." "Okay," Gust responded, "I'm going to keep buying from the Egyptians." Most of the Egyptians' initial efforts to sell weapons to the agency resembled a Keystone Cops movie. The most preposterous moment came during a test firing of Mohammed's new briefcase-sized tank destroyer. Once more, a general delivered a rousing briefing and a stalwart Egyptian fired at the target. But this time, the round, acting like a boomerang, turned back on the watchers. "Oh, shit!" Charlie yelled as they all hurled themselves flat. "We decided not to buy any of those," Wilson remembers. There had been much wringing of Egyptian hands before the demonstration, ostensibly over the disclosure of such valuable state secrets to such known friends of Israel. Art Alper had gone to some lengths to conceal his religious affiliations. After scrambling up from the ground, Gust had quipped to the embarrassed General Yeya, "I don't think the Jews have to worry about this one." As compensation for these little setbacks and to the confusion and dismay of his security officials, Mohammed offered to let the agency delegation go into the Army's most sensitive research and development facility, where his weapons people were finishing production of a shoulder-fired anti-aircraft missile that he said was not only more effective than an SA-7, but would prove superior to the American Stinger. No one at this plant was ever prepared for visitors, but unlike everything else the Americans had seen in Egypt, this facility was operated like a sophisticated high-tech laboratory in the United States. "It was the cleanest place in Cairo," remembers Avrakatos. "The men and women wore white coats like doctors and seemed to have been educated at technical schools in the U.S. like Carnegie Mellon." At first, Charlie figured he had led the CIA to the silver bullet that would at last bring down the hind, and once inside, Gust could not restrain his impulse to snoop. On a later trip with Paul, the psychological warfare expert whom Gust complimentarily describes as a sneaky son of a bitch, the visitors dispersed to explore as much of the facility as possible. The Egyptians always looked quite terrified when the American spies, taking advantage of Mohammed's license, entered areas ordinarily forbidden. In one sealed-off room, Paul and Gust came across three scientists who didn't look Egyptian, and Gust said, "Assalamu alaikum," Arabic for hello. Two of them responded with bonjour. Gust now knew that the French were working with the Egyptians. It was not long ago that Egypt and Israel had been at war, and the fear was that the Americans would run off and warn Jerusalem. But once again, Gust, with Charlie as guarantor, gave his word that all of the agency's dealings with Mohammed would remain a secret. In keeping with all of Mohammed's other anti-aircraft solutions, this weapon never lived up to the field marshal's promises, and wasn't even ready to be tested when the CIA was prepared to buy it. After all those disastrous mishaps at Mohammed's Arms Bazaar, the CIA contingent finally stumbled across a number of things they very much wanted. Thanks again to Charlie, Mohammed had offered to let the CIA men exchange information with his unconventional warfare experts. The Egyptians had something to talk about here because they had gone through a brutal guerrilla war in Yemen just a few years before. Fighting with tribesmen in mountainous terrain similar to Afghanistan, they had learned what works and what doesn't. They might have bombed out in the big-ticket items that Wilson had wanted the agency to buy, but at the Egyptian Special Warfare School, the counterinsurgency experts began showing Alper, Vickers, and Pratt items that would clearly be devastating in the hands of the Mujahideen. What got Alper and then Avrakatos particularly excited was the cornucopia of city warfare devices that the Egyptians had stored in this facility. "It was incredible stuff that most American minds are not devious enough to think up," remembers Avrakatos. "But if you've been around 5,000 years like the Egyptians and survived, you come up with some great ways of killing your enemies." He was referring to such things as bicycle bombs. They had hundreds of ways to conceal bombs, or, if you will, terrorist devices, but they had worked out bombs that were concealed in wooden carts that carry manure or special wheelbarrows. The only question, as Avrakatos saw it, was whether this deadly cornucopia could be effective against the Soviets in Kabul and other cities in Afghanistan. Alper insisted it would be very useful. "Then the decision was left to me," Gust recalled. "Do I want to order bicycle bombs to park in front of an officer's headquarters? Yes. That's what spreads fear." Another senior CIA officer in Avrakatos's shoes might well have chosen to pass on the offering of urban terrorist devices. That's the kind of thing the CIA was not supposed to be doing. But Avrakatos decided they would be quite effective. Beyond that, Gust calculated that the congressman who had opened the door for him to make these purchases happened to be on one of the committees that serves as a watchdog for the agency. Gust could hardly be accused of trying to pull a fast one on Congress. Thanks to Mohammed's tour, the CIA's military team soon discovered a whole range of low-level weapons they wanted for the jihad, like Egyptian limpet mines that Alper later modified so they could be attached magnetically to Soviet trucks heading down the Salong Highway. The Egyptians taught Alper how to delay the fuses beyond the time period he thought possible. "It was very useful for going after tunnels. We managed to block the Salong for days. The Yemenis had done it to the Egyptians showed our guys how to do it, and our guys showed the Mujahideen how to do it." The Egyptians' list also included screaming Mimis, plastic mines, mines that popped out of the ground, trip mines, and wire mines. Gust was now sensing genuine opportunity, enchanted with his stature as Charlie's running mate as they drove in air-conditioned cars through the desert to be given red carpet treatment at whatever facility they might choose to descend on. It was on one such visit that he stumbled across a weapon that thrilled him like no other. The agency had been looking for a rocket with a range of over 10 kilometers that could not be traceable to the United States or NATO, and they found it in one of Mohammed's warehouses, the Katyusha. During World War II, at the siege of Stalingrad, this 122-millimeter rocket had made the difference. A huge, screaming artillery round, it chilled the Wehrmacht with its terrible noise and striking power, and had been immortalized in such Soviet patriotic songs as the Stalin Organ. "We didn't think we could ever find the fucking thing," says Gust. But after spotting 54 of them in a warehouse, he had the Egyptians test fire one, and he still remembers his terror. "If you've ever heard one of these come at you, there's no way you wouldn't crap in your pants. I was 3 miles away from where it hit, and I was scared. It was a frightening experience, like being in a minor earthquake. You just can't imagine what it would be like to be within 50 feet of one of those things." Gust bought every one of Mohammed's Katyushas at tens of thousands each, and soon the Mujahideen were blasting away at the airport near Kabul, creating holes the size of football fields as far away as the city's outskirts. The French ambassador reported that although the rocket had landed 17 blocks away, it had cracked the foundations of his Kabul embassy. The Russians were mortified. Ultimately, terrorizing the Soviets and making them leave was the name of Avrakatos's game. The discovery of the Katyusha at that point in the war was just what the doctor ordered. Gust didn't care that the rocket wasn't accurate. He wanted to frighten and demoralize the 40th Army, the KGB, and all those Communist Party bastards ruling the roost in Kabul. The agency had already started trying to turn the lights out in the occupied capital by having the Mujahideen blow up electricity pylons. The night always belonged to the Mujahideen, but particularly when there was no light. And if a screaming Katyusha could be added to the mix, well, that was just the perfect twist of the psychological dagger. Avrakatos first saw the rocket fired at the end of 1984. By February 1985, he had commissioned the Egyptians to open up a production line of Katyushas, ordering 700 of them by year's end. They also became a part of the weapons mix against the previously invincible Soviet Air Force. By firing these rockets at the airfields, the Afghans could at least spread fear in the pilots' minds and occasionally take out a target. "We had the Mujahideen firing the Katyushas from 10 kilometers away twice a day," says Gust. "They sound like 30 freight trains coming in all at once." Things were falling into place on this trip, with Gust acquiring odd, diverse instruments for Mike Vickers' Symphony of Armaments. "You can imagine what the Russians were starting to discover once we started pouring in all of these new weapons," he says. "When they went into a village in 1983 or 1984, they would find a few 303 rifles. But a year later, they'd have a much bigger fight on their hands. And at the end, they'd find 25 AK-47s and all sorts of ordnance. They could sense the enormity of the volume."